The Bible isn't a science book. I'm not going to go into every minutia of all the interesting things that we could speculate on. But if you want to whet your appetite on more of this, if you want to really dig in deep, there's a great resource, Chuck Missler, k-house.org. You can get his Genesis series, and he'll tell you all the things that I wouldn't be able to go into. He has a lot more of a scientific brain than mine, and in fact, he'll make your head spin. Some of the things that are in the front, the cutting edge of science, that from a biblical perspective, really, really good, as well as discovery.org, another website you can check out, and answersingenesis.org. Very fascinating. But of course, we are looking at the creation. In the beginning, the first verse we looked at, God created the heavens and the earth. And I said, if you can accept that, everything else is easy. Everything else is a piece of cake. You won't have trouble with any miracles of the Bible, any other ways of God, any of the other things the Bible mentions. And listen, you won't have trouble as well with some of the problems you face personally, because so often we magnify this issue we're going through, and we all go through pains and struggles and loss of loved ones or health issues, something. There's always in a family something we're dealing with. And sometimes we get our eyes so much on those things, we take our eyes off of God. And, well, again, if we can accept the first verse of Genesis, that problem, if our God is that big, then our problem really is not as big as we thought. That God is actually using it. And in fact, the Bible says He causes all things to work together for good to those that love Him and are the called according to His purpose. So we admittedly, as Christians, start with this presupposition. We start. We don't have to go back beyond, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. We start there. And unashamedly so. Because we know that the only alternative is to start with nothing that became something and then blew up. Now, you know, think about it. Some, you're going to see this on websites. People will mock, oh, you believe in the super guy upstairs who started it all. And, well, you believe in something that came out of nothing and then it exploded. So, you know, I say mock them right back. In fact, you know, sometimes we tend to get intimidated when someone throws a little bit of science our way. In fact, as a young Christian, I picked up some science that I thought was really proving the Bible, and some of it turned out to be not so accurate. And they'll mock that. Oh, you know, believe that the moon dust on the moon was supposed to show the age of the universe not being that old. And of course, that's an argument that we don't use anymore as creationists. But if they throw that at you, I got to tell you, they have to revise the science books every 7 years, because even a 7-year-old biology book contains a lot of errors in it. It's just the nature of science. It's inquisitive. It's not solid. And, you know, there's certain, obviously, scientific principles that are pretty clear, God, the way God made things. But there's a lot of hypotheses and theories and ideas that oftentimes get discarded. In fact, they used to tell women in the science books that were pregnant that if you're pregnant and you want to keep from gaining too much weight, which is very unhealthy, then it would be a good idea to smoke cigarettes because that'll keep you from gaining weight. Now, yeah, you laugh. Yeah, it's stupid now, we know. But what about those poor women that follow the scientific professors in their white gowns who knew what they were talking about? We have to really think through what we believe. And as a Christian, I have no problem starting with the presupposition, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And that starts it for me. You know, in the year 1861, the French Academy of Sciences published a list of 51 scientific facts which it was alleged disproved something in the Bible. Today, the Bible remains, and those 51 so-called scientific facts are all not accepted by men of science today. And the Bible has such superiority in every aspect. Though it's not a science book, every time it mentions something about nature, something about the physical world, something that could be construed as a scientific statement, it's eerily accurate. And just remember, if Moses wrote this, which we believe he did because the Bible says, Jesus said he did, he attributed the first 5 books of the Bible to Moses. He did not include, remember, any of the crazy science that the Egyptians would have held, and Moses was trained in all of their universities. But and even if he believed it personally, that maybe the world was flat or he had other ideas of science, they never find their way in the Bible. because it shows that God wrote this, I believe. The Bible needs no revision. It's here. Though it's not a science book, it just breathes of a book written way beyond its time. And even some of the prophets of Isaiah and Job, they probably had science in their day and age. The Babylonian science is really wacky if you read some of that stuff, what they believed about the nature of the world. But the Bible doesn't say it. In fact, in the day of Moses, they believed that the basic elements, fire, water, air, were like that was the foundation of the world. But instead, the Bible says, in the beginning, time, God created force, the heavens and the earth, matter. You've got energy, you've got matter, you've got time. All presupposed here in the very beginning. The very notion that time had a beginning is actually a biblical concept. Sir Frederick Boyle in the Annual Reviews of Astronomy said, a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as biology. And certainly the more we've learned from that statement, which he made in 1982, even more so many scientists are coming even against all the pressure to conform. I mean, the federal courts are actually penalizing scientists in the universities and high schools that might even question Darwinian evolution. Of course, the whole movie Expelled about that. So we just need to be aware of these things, and I think hold lightly onto what is so-called science. Dig deeper, keep studying, keep researching, but I think you're on a solid ground when you hold, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And we notice the beginning of this. We came to verse 6, but I want to back up to verse 3. With the days of creation, beginning in day one, God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light and that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. Now this concept of light we just touched on, but I'm very fascinated with it. I did a lot more reading on it just because it's intriguing. Some of the things that scientists are trying to discover, they've debated for years and years about whether it's particle, little particles, streams of particles, or is it wave, just energy? Because even when you throw a rock in the water and you see the wave created, the water actually isn't moving. It's the energy wave that's moving through the water. Water's staying right there. And it's a fascinating thing, just this idea of energy, of wave energy. Is that what light is? But the more they've discovered, they've realized it has properties of both. It shows that it reacts to gravity as well as it is an electromagnetic energy. So the quantum physics is fascinating in that it's discovered and it's really pinned down that it's little photons, little bundles of energy that are being pressed through. It slows down in water, but then when it comes out of water the other side, somehow, inexplicably, it speeds up again. What gives it the focus to speed up? It's just a fascinating thing. But I look at light from a moral sense. Light does reveal. And the darkness, of course, I've mentioned that darkness is simply an absence of light, but there is actually a thought that the Bible does say God created darkness as well. He created light and darkness. So what is darkness? If that's the case, it could well be that God was speaking about what we have observed in the universe we call black holes. And they're believed to be such large stars that have imploded, the gravitational forces so large that even light can't escape. And it absorbs it all into it. Now here, listen, before I lose you on this, I want to apply some real cool moral thought to this. When the light of the gospel shines upon our hearts, when the idea and the belief of God comes and our eye is opened and the light floods our being, what happens is we then become aware of God. Once I was blind, now I see. There's a sense now of God. And listen, apart from that, we are like that black hole where the light hits us and it's just absorbed. Everything is about me. Everything is about what I want. I use people for me. All the things out there are for my pleasure. I want to be. And so all of the light is just absorbed. But what happens is when my eyes are open And I believe in the light of the gospel that Jesus died for me on the cross, and that God sent His Son and He died for me, and I can have life in His name. There's something transforming, that from glory to glory I'm transformed. So now I reflect His light. He shines and I can't help but spill out on others. Love enters the soul. Jesus spoke about if your eye is dark, the whole body, your whole life is dark. If you don't let the light of the glory of God in your heart, then you are just like that black hole. But light is a beautiful way to start. In fact, all of the physical universe, according to these quantum physics guys that know a whole lot more than I can even try to understand, try to express that without light, nothing makes sense. Even the speed of light, it has to be exactly so, otherwise it throws everything off. That light is naturally the beginning. Even they say it, and here God said in the very beginning, "Let there be light," and there was light. Verse 6, he says, "Then God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. Thus God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so." And God called the firmament. Now you wonder, what's the firmament? All you have to do is keep reading, and he tells you, verse 8, God called the firmament heaven. So the evening and the morning were the second day. Well, now I'm really confused. Heaven, waters above, waters below, what's he talking about? Well, when you read the next verse, it makes sense then. God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together. So it's heavens plural, remember? So the heaven that he made the waters above obviously wasn't like where God dwells, and it certainly wasn't the stellar heavens, but it was believed to be the atmospheric heaven. And that at some point in the beginning, before the flood, obviously we don't see this now, though there is water vapor, and certainly I think it's some, I don't know how many trillion tons of water fall on the earth every day from the clouds raining. However, this is a little bit different. Apparently, it's believed by some creation scientists that there was a canopy of water. Now again, there's no way of absolutely proving because we weren't there. But it does answer a lot of puzzling things we see in the world today. It answers some things that are puzzling in the Bible, like the ages of those pre-diluvian people, how they could live 800-900 years old. With this canopy of water, they would have been protected from many cosmic rays, which, you know, are actually part of the genetic defects that are caused by these cosmic rays that we are bombarded with. In fact, you know, by the time I actually say one sentence, you've had some trillion neutrinos pass through your body. And most of them never do anything, but every now and then something hits a gene and, you know, it's a ridiculously amount of space in your body that these tiny little neutrinos, these little particles smaller than electrons, supposedly go through your body and you don't even know it. There's so many mysteries about this, but here's the thing, the canopy would have protected and would naturally, they would have replenished their cells. Your cells replenish themselves every so often. Your body is completely different from what it was 7 years ago. Not one cell is the same. Everything has been renewed. The information that's stored there is passed on to the next cell. But if that's the case, if you're totally regenerated, then why do you age? Because of this cell degradation in the replication process, believed to be caused by a lot of the cosmic rays that we live in. And without that, you could potentially live a lot longer. And of course, well, now the gene defects have already been caused. But in that time, imagine what this canopy must have been. Plus, it would have also answered why the whole world would have been like a tropical paradise where ferns, we found fossils of ferns that are 50 feet tall, asparagus ferns. Now, I don't know the last time you grew asparagus, but it didn't reach 50 feet. Well, you could feed the whole neighborhood on one asparagus. But this was the pre-diluvian age. And of course, there are evidence in the fossil record of these incredible plants and lush vegetation that would have occurred, but perhaps the flood changed all that. Obviously, the mist came up from the garden to water the garden, to water the earth. It would be like a terrarium. You know, if you ever had a terrarium, you just put water in once, you cover it, and it just keeps recycling. That would have perhaps been the case with the canopy. Would have just been a mist, high humidity. The plants would have received all the water just from the mist. end of the day, it's still speculative. We don't really know for certain. But then day three comes. Then God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together in one place and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. So he creates the area of the dry land. And then God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth. And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass and the herb that yields seed according to its kind, the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind. God saw that it was good. And the evening and the morning were the third day. So this third day, he divides the waters, creates the dry land, and then brings forth the vegetation. The very concept of a seed is quite interesting. If you ever really studied a seed, really look close. I mean, the very fact of vegetation, a seed is a marvelous information storage packet that has all the details of that plant, and it's never even related to the size. You can have a tiny little seed, it could be a huge tree, and this huge seed could be just a small plant. You know, the avocado seed, huge seed, not that big of a plant. Then you have other tiny little seeds that grow into huge things. All that information stored. And the fascinating thing is the whole propagation of the plants and the seeds that are created and the need for pollination so that the seeds then will produce from the flowers. Then the seeds, once they're produced, they all have different ways that are constructed in which to disperse them. You know, you have those little fluffy puffs of whatever that cause the seeds, the wind hits it and they just float away from the mother plant so that they'll find a place apart with some fresh sunlight to grow. I grew up in Michigan and I always remember around a particular time in summer, the cottonwood trees. And if you've ever seen in the middle of summer when the seeds start dispersing from the trees, these little puffs of little cotton fall, it looks like it's snowing in the middle of the summer. It's amazing. But all it is God's unique design to get those seeds to fall away from the tree so that they can spread. Then other seeds have little Velcro spurs attached to them that attach to your socks when you walk by. Or the little critters with the fur, you know, and then they're dispersed. And other seeds have a little fruity covering so that it attracts the animals to eat them. And that they deposit them somewhere else, they now can grow when they've already got their built-in fertilizer already. Amazing little design. In fact, some seeds, you know, that they have such a hard exterior. The case is so impenetrable that it needs a harsh enzyme to eat away that outer covering or it'll never germinate. And the digestion tracts of the animals that eat it are the exact enzyme that can break down that seed pod. I mean, it's so interwoven. More than that is just the connection between plants and animals. The anatomy of a leaf, the chloroplasts and all of the things, all the things that are there used to design this procedure of converting light and carbon dioxide, I call it dioxide, it's a bad habit from Michigan, carbon dioxide. You add light, carbon dioxide, and you have water, and then it produces oxygen and glucose or a simple sugar. I mean, it's fascinating because then you've got the animals that need the simple sugars to live and they need the oxygen to breathe. And the plants need the carbon dioxide that the animals give off as well as, you know, the light, and they take the water and the energy to produce this. This amazing, simple manufacturing plant, pardon the pun, to produce what is needed in this world. And it's a much more complicated system than it sounds, just converting those two things. When you do the math on it and you do the chemistry on it, it's a fascinating thing and how it all works together. Well, this is God's design. And then day four, God said, let there be lights in the firmament of the heaven. Now, the odd thing is that he creates the sun and the moon and the stars after he creates all of the vegetation. Now, there are those that, as I'm even reading this, you may have been taught or learned somewhere about the day-age theory, that these days are really not 24-hour periods, but they're long ages. And that would all be well and good, except for the fact you've got a problem here. You've got the plants coming before the sun, and of course, you have a long age, you're going to have an issue. Now, obviously, the Lord lights up in Revelation the temple and the earth with his own presence, and presumably he's doing that here before he creates the sun and the moon and the stars. But the problem is there's no reason to get more than a normal day out of this. See, the problem is when you read the Bible, and people have to read into their own presuppositions, they have to read into the scriptures to get out what they want. I've heard some wild, fanciful interpretations of Genesis 1 just because of someone's view that evolution is a fact, so therefore we've got to squeeze it into the Bible. And theistic evolutionists talk about how God used evolution. Now, I have to say as well, evolution is a big thing. It's a big feature. We see evidence of things evolving from within the species, but there's no evidence, or at least the evidence they have is much disputed evidence, there's any evolution from kind to kind to kind. I really believe that when the Bible says in 6 days, in fact, later on when he gives us the law and the Sabbath day rest, he says in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth and the sea and all that is in them, and he rested on the seventh day, so you should rest on the seventh day, obviously implying that we're talking about normal days here. Not really something you have to get out beyond the meaning of the word. In fact, there's a book called In 6 Days. Some 50 of the top scientists in the United States and the world put together this, you know, their reasons why they believe 6 days is perfectly reasonable when it comes to the age of the earth as well. But just the way that God designed things, all of the processes. So he says, let their lights be in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day and night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years, and let them be for lights in the firmament of the heavens to give light on the earth. And it was so. So you've got two reasons here for the lights. You've got let them be for signs and seasons, and certainly the earth revolving around the sun at a tilt of 23 1/4 degrees gives us those seasons, as well as the moon, of course, the right exact proportion, the size of our moon, you know, keeping the stability of the orbit and the tidal forces and all that sort of thing that are exactly needed for life. But we're also for light. So you have the signs, you've got the seasons, you've got lights. Now, as far as the signs go, you know, it's an interesting study when you start looking into the constellations. And unfortunately, all of the information, I believe, that some of these signs would have pointed to, the Bible says that every one of the stars, he called the host out by name. God gave names to all of the stars. If you can imagine, there's so many. Well, you can actually have a star named after you if you want. You can go to the International Star Registry, and they sometimes advertise it around those late times of season when you're very gullible and you want to buy anything. Get a star named after you. Look, I got a star named after me. The only problem is God already gave him a name. I'm sorry. You get to heaven, you're going to say, that's my star. No, I'm sorry. The name is this. You're going to be very disappointed that you spent your money on such frivolity. Point is, back in those days, you know, a lot of the ancients, again, we've been so programmed to think way back in that, like cavemen people. No, they weren't cavemen people walking around. There were people that lived in caves and drew pictures on the walls. Job actually talks about them, the degenerates of the earth that, you know, stepped out of society and lived in caves and wrote on the walls. I think you could probably go to certain psychiatric hospitals and find people that write on the walls. So it's not really proving anything. But back in those days, these people were genius. When we get into looking at creation in the first 6 chapters, you're going to find some of the brilliant genius where one guy was creating, he went out and created music, the musical scale, and another guy went out and invented metallurgy. And I mean, brilliant people that could do anything because God made them. But in this picture, I believe that there are signs in the heavens and that many of these names of the stars tell a story. Bullinger does a book called The Gospel in the Stars, and if you're interested in that subject, it's fascinating. But unfortunately, Babylon has corrupted that, and the zodiac and astrology, you know, predicting your life and your future and your, you know, the people would actually believe this. is quite troubling, because if you don't believe in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, because it's too difficult for you to believe, yet you will believe that the conjunction of where the stars are somehow determining your life, what do you believe if you turn away from God? I had a very intelligent relative who, I spilled salt at the dinner table one time and he threw it over his shoulder, and I said, what was that? And he goes, well, just superstition. I go, wait a minute, excuse me, you're the news director of a station here in this area, brilliant guy, I love talking to you, all kinds of things. You believe that throwing that salt over your shoulder is going to keep you from getting bad luck? Well, I'm not taking any chances. I purposely spilled it again. He throws it over his shoulder. I said, I can't believe I spilled it again. He goes, stop it. And throws it over his shoulder. I was amazed. But again, what you believe when you don't believe in God. But I'm not going to get onto that, because he'll probably hear this tape and be mad at me. The interesting thing is the constellations that we know even today, in every language and culture, the names, they're changed, but overall the message is still there, even though it's been corrupted. And I believe the wise men of Daniel would have understood probably a lot more about the message there that led them to that place in Bethlehem more than we could even understand. So God made these lights. He set them in the firmament of the heavens, verse 17, to give light to the earth, to rule over the day, over the night, to divide the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. So the evening and the morning were the fourth day. You know, if you want to think about the vastness of space, Job, chapter 38, God challenges Job. Can you bind the cluster of the Pleiades? Can you loose the belt of Orion? Speaking of the constellations. I think it's a great thing to go outside at night on a cloudless night and just look up. If you can get away from some of the light pollution, wonderful thing just to contemplate and think of the majesty of these galaxies and stars that are so filling the universe. And then when you realize some of them, like you can learn some things in a little bit of basic astronomy, like in the constellation Orion, for example, one of my favorites, because you've got the planet or the star Rigel, the bluish star, because it's supposedly coming toward us. And then you've got Betelgeuse, or however you want to pronounce it, Betelgeuse, the top star on the top, which is a reddish star, which I believe is going away from us. And then you've got the belt, those three stars in the middle. It's one of the very prominent constellations. You can see it most of the time. Maybe you never knew what it was, but that star, Betelgeuse, is amazing. It's so big. You've heard me say this before, probably, that you could take our Earth revolving around our sun, put it inside this star, and still have 100 million miles to spare. God just stretched forth the heavens, the Bible says. Then verse 20, God said, let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures, and let the birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament of the heavens. So God created the great sea creatures and every living thing that moves. So you see here the birds flying in the firmament, that is in the atmosphere. The great sea creatures and every living thing that moves, which the waters abounded according to their kind, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Notice everything according to its kind. You'll see this in the next passage. Everything according to its kind. God established the information, the code, for every living thing. Even in your own DNA. In fact, scientists were shocked to discover, when they finally broke the code, to discover that it's a digital code. Our computers are based on a digital code that between the, you use 0 and 1. Those are the only two things your computer understands. But the conjunction of that 0 and 1 in the right order, it means a letter. And then that letter can be composed of this, and then eventually can be composed in very, very complicated things just from those two things, a 0 and a 1. That's how your computers work. But the DNA is composed of three proteins. And I don't know the names of them, and I don't really think you care. But it's a fascinating digital code that, basically outlines and details everything about your life. Everything about your body, every little hair that's produced, every little feature about you is digitized. And it's so complex. This is what has caused people like Anthony Flew to eventually bail on Darwinian evolution, because they just, when it comes to The origin of species, fine. Within species, there can be many changes, but that's all written in the code as well. For example, if you mow down a bunch of mosquitoes in your backyard with malathion, there will be always a percentage of mosquitoes that are resistant to malathion, and now they survive, and then they breed, and now the next time you spray them with malathion, they won't respond to it. You've got resistant mosquitoes, then you have to come up with another chemical. The funny thing is, and of course they use this in evolution to prove that you adapt. Well, God created the adaptation process. The genes that were resistant to that particular chemical were now the ones that were being produced because all the other ones were dead. So now you have resistant mosquitoes. The funny thing is, though, what they don't tell you, these people that use this proof, is that if you stop spraying malathion, the same mosquitoes that were producing this resistance will eventually start producing ones that don't have it, and they go back to what they were. And when I was taught it in school, and they use the same proofs now, the dark moths and the light-colored moths, that during the Industrial Revolution, when there was more soot being accumulating on the building, all the white-colored ones were being eaten because they would be seen against the building and the birds were picking them off. And the dark-colored ones that blended in survived. So the adaptation of these little moths, but in no case did you ever find a moth being turned into a butterfly or turned into a mouse or turned into anything else. God created the kinds within the kinds to have great speciation, just like a dog. Any dog can breed together. And you have all these different breeds that you specialized, you know, by breeding them certain features within genes, and eventually you have all these different kinds of dogs. But if you let all the dogs just interbreed over a period of time, you'd have one dog, including the wolf, the coyote, all the dog kind. You would find they'd all have that interbreeding, or they could all interbreed because God said they can produce after their kind. So we get so twisted with this stuff and the way people look at it with their presuppositions. But, you know, God created things after their kind. And even in the fossil record, there is absolutely no clear evidence of any transitional forms of something changing in between kinds. In fact, you have these huge deposits of fossils with an abundance of complex life immediately appearing, nothing before that. You know those troglobites that they'll, you know, and all those things that you see and the so-called primitive things? Well, millions and millions of these things that probably lived quite well in the pre-diluvian atmospheric conditions. But what was before those things? So there's nothing. They just, all of a sudden, instantaneous, you've got this complex life, which we were always taught was very, very simple. Blobs of protoplasm just coming together. No, in fact, inside the cell, it's unbelievably complex. And the odds of it just occurring, you couldn't put together a string of 350 beads in the right order by chance. If you had a bunch of colored beads, they're all numbered and you put them out there and then you just picked them up at random, the odds of them being all in order would be 1 in 10 with some 50 zeros after it. In other words, anything with 10 zeros after it is absurd. It's impossible. And the reason why is because there's only so many square inches in the universe and there's only so many seconds in 18 billion years. And even if you took every square inch of the universe for every second and you gave them an opportunity to try to get this in order, you'd still need 1,000 universes of 18 billion years in order to possibly get one chance of that happening. And that string of 340 beads is very simple compared to the complexity of what's going on in every one of your cells. Michael Behe, who wrote Darwin's Black Box, when Darwin wrote his theories, he believed the cell was a simple little thing. It was the black box, a mystery. No one could break the code. No one could get in it. So they just considered it a very simple thing. Now you can go and rent out Privileged Planet, and you will blow your mind at what's going on in every one of your cells. In fact, verse 22 says, God blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters and the seas, let the birds multiply in the earth, and the evening and the morning of the first day. This idea of propagating the species, of they multiplying, because what's going on in every one of your cells is amazing. It's miraculous. I'll give you an example. There's about 125 miles of strands of DNA in your cells. Can you imagine that? But try this. If I gave you 125 miles of fishing line and I asked you to roll it up into a ball, it'd be about the size of a basketball. Then I said, now every 2 hours I want you to unroll it, copy it, and then roll them back up. You know, that's happening in your cells every 2 hours. I mean, the complexity is just crazy. And it doesn't get tangled. And it's in all of the code and replicating itself is passed on to the next one so perfectly. And people will look at this, but for some reason they will not. And I believe God has put it in them that you must believe in God. It can't make sense any other way. But more than that, even if you have all the information written on the code, here's the problem. It would be like if every one of you had a different instrument in your hands. And every one of you knew how to play all of those instruments. You have the makings of a beautiful orchestra, right? Everybody's got the knowledge, the ability, the instrument, it's all there. You lack one thing. A conductor that puts it all together. And the music score. Okay, you've got the music score. It's all the code. You need the conductor. What comes first? What comes second? It's believed, in fact, this is the mystery of the cell replication, is what is driving this thing? And it's believed by some, and I don't believe they're far off, that God is involved in every cell division, orchestrating this music of the universe that we can't even fathom. That's how big our God is. How big was your problem when you came in this morning? What are you facing right now? What is it that you're going through? Have you conceived, have you heard that God is not weary? He doesn't sleep, He doesn't slumber. He sits above the earth. The earth is, the universe is a span to His hands. He holds the nations as a drop in the bucket, Isaiah 40 says. He is amazing. Well, then verse 24 says, then God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature according to its kind, cattle and creeping things and the beasts of the earth, each according to its kind. And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over the cattle, over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. I think the first most obvious thing is, who is God speaking to here? Let us make man in our image. We have a problem here. Our image? Well, what do we have? Us? This is one of the two places that the plural verb Elohim, or noun Elohim, is attached to a plural verb. Most of the time, Elohim is attached to a singular verb. God does, or God is, in the sense of a singular. God speaks, not gods speak. And if this is one of the only two places, the other one is in when he confuses the languages at Babel. Come, let us go down and confuse their language. There's something about man that stands out here that I believe invokes this need for the plural verb. Because there is an idea of man in God's image that we have been created body, soul, and spirit. God is Father, Son, Holy Spirit. There's a likeness that we've been created, not in the sense that just physical, like, well, God is like us. He's about, 6 feet tall or whatever and has, this and that feature about him. It's not that. The feature that we are made, because God is spirit, yet there is an aspect of us being made in His image, which, listen, He makes us, this is the miracle, this is the mystery. He makes us on day six with all of the other mammals and animals and earth animals, land animals, and then we're made. There is a connection between us and the animals. We have a body that's like an animal. We live in this physical dimension. But we're different from the animals. This is the problem that I think is rooted within the rejection of God, is that now if it's all a process that just happened by chance, then you are nothing more than an evolved animal. There is no really higher purpose for you. You're just here by accident. And if you keep pounding this into the brains of our young people in universities and high schools, then eventually they're going to begin living this way without a real sense that I am different. There's a higher purpose for me. I want to just now gratify my sexual needs. I want to gratify my needs for food and for water. I want to fight the survival of the fittest. You know, I'm going to push it. I'm going to claw my way to the top. And it doesn't matter who I step on, because after all, survival of the fittest. If this is the mentality, then where is love? Where is sacrifice? Where do these greater qualities come from out of this Darwinian model? No, God made us in His image. He made us. The Bible says God made man upright. That alone should get your attention. If you've ever been in one of the museums and they show you the pictures of the, you know, starting out with the simple creatures and then the ape and then, you know, what, or at least the proto, whatever it was before the ape, they say. And eventually it shows how we evolved into modern man. And they have the pictures of the Cro-Magnon man and the Java man and the Java the Hutt man. And sorry, I couldn't resist that one. You have all of these pictures. And, you know, of course, none of those exist. They're just one. This came from a tooth that was actually an extinct pig. And he was, you know, doctored up to look like a human tooth. And, you know, there's a lot of things they've thrown at us over the years, the hoaxes that we've had to uncover. But at the end of the day, still, they don't have anything. When I went to university, they had Lucy. She was an Australopithecus afarensis. And if I remember correctly, and why do I remember that dumb thing? I'll tell you, it bugs me. They pounded that into my brain. I can't forget it. But Lucy was supposed to be, you know, this ape-like creature that walked upright. And so they thought, this is a transitional form. And yet they found the skull like hundreds of yards away, and the rest of the bones were scattered among human footprints. It just didn't make sense. But that's, you know, what they put together, and we're supposed to trust them. But here's the thing. He made us upright. Do you ever think about if we were evolving to walk upright? It is the most inefficient mode of transportation. Every little furry creature on fours runs faster than us. How is that superior? Not superior at all. You'll be much more susceptible to being caught by lions and tigers. You don't have the capacity to climb a tree like a monkey or outrun like a gazelle. You're basically very vulnerable. It doesn't make sense. So, you know, the idea of this walking upright, but I believe there's another reason why God made us upright. He, of course, we're made on the sixth day with the animals. We have our feet on the ground. We're connected to this earth. We know that. We have our natural urges and desires, biological needs. But there's something in the soul of man that's different. Created in God's image, that only when you know Him can you discover what your purpose is. You're made to walk upright, to lift your hands, to contemplate who you are, to imagine the universe, to imagine, to think, to contemplate, to ponder. I don't see, now you've got a pet and your dog goes outside and, you know, that dog running around the yard is looking for everything that's connected to this earth. If you see him in the lounge chair looking up in the heavens, contemplating himself, you've got a problem on your hands. But your dogs don't do that. My cats, they're involved in the critters. They're just interested in this world. They're not sitting there thinking. They don't contemplate. We have speech. We have communication. We have the ability to pass something of our soul onto someone else. There is an amazing difference. And if people try to say you are nothing but some evolved form from some creature that moved one, this went to apes, this went to man, you've missed it. God made you. God created man in His own image, verse 27. In the image of God, He created him. And then He says, male and female, He created them. Now, I do a whole message on verse 27, so I'm not going to go into this whole subject. But just let's just say that it's very plain in the beginning, God made us male and female. And there is no confusion here. Now, because we live in a fallen world, and some might even be born with both male and female parts, and you've got all kinds of oddities there, you've got all kinds of, you know, things that I would call aberrant from this, we cannot sit back and make the aberrant normal because we want to go to school, make everybody feel good. There are certain things that are right and wrong. Right now, you've got evolution as the center of the culture war, I believe, and then you've got sexual orientation as the next front. You've got two major fronts that you as a Christian, believing in God, are feeling like you are on the defensive because of the direction this world is going. Now, I can certainly empathize with someone that maybe has desires that are not natural. But I have desires that are not natural either. You could call them natural, and I've got to control them. And certainly, because what I am is much more defined by just what my desires are. And God created the male and female. You know, I mean, the very fact that people, I remember the unisex culture, there was blurring the thing, there's no difference between men and women, you hear for so long. There's huge differences between men and women. Huge differences. I mean, even in children, you know, mom and dads, raising kids in the home, come on. I go into this subject, but so I'm not going to go into this. If you want to get that message that I did in the marriage conference on this, I'd encourage you, because it's a lot of fun looking at those differences. But, you know, just the way you raise kids. You know, who does a little boy run to when he hurts himself? The dad's pushing him, go faster, climb higher. And mom's saying, no, take it easy, please. But then he hurts himself. Who does he go to? He goes to mom. He's not going to go to dad. Why? Dad's going to go, oh, wow. What'd you do? How'd you do that? Did you learn anything? Mom! Mom's just going to comfort. Oh, honey, let me kiss your boo-boo. He likes that. He's not going to go to dad. Dad's about training. Dad's about, what'd you learn from this thing? We're like, oh, that looks pretty bad. Yeah. Mom is over there, oh, my poor baby. It's like we're different, but God made us that way. You see, I think it's a wonderful thing when you raise children with a mother and a father in the home, which is the way it should be, because then that child has the greatest advantage. He gets the comfort of a mother and the training of a father. And meanwhile, most of the time in Christian families, foolishly, the husband and the wife are fighting. Now, you shouldn't do that. No, you shouldn't do that. You got to be like me. No, you got to be like me. Wah, 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 wah. And both are right. You're both right. Moms, you're doing exactly what mom should do. But don't make him a sissy boy by making your husband try to be like you. And dads, don't make your mom to be like the dad and the disciplinarian and the force and put her in that role. You know what? I believe those roles are important. Now, I'm generalizing because there are sometimes people are going to have different views of this. But generally speaking, this is the way he made us. God made us male and female. Now, some will say, well, wait, chapter 2 talks about how God made them male and female. So what's this? You know, the Bible's very clear. It gives you the overview, and then chapter 2, now he's going to get you down to the nitty-gritty of how he made man. He's just mentioning in passing right here. Then God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And I believe there is a lot here that you can say in regard to our care of the environment. Though, again, I'm no tree hugger by any stretch, I do believe that the unrestrained greed of man has largely polluted this world in many ways. And, you know, thank God we actually are moving the other direction. However, sometimes even that can be too far. You know, when you start jeopardizing human life over the spotted owl, you've got a problem. And it gets a little bit too crazy. I mean, when we were looking at property, things were determined wetlands because a certain little plant was growing. You know, they've found some pretty unscrupulous people that, you know, that don't want development. And they would actually go out there and they'd plant these little plants so that the environmental guys would come in, oh, you can't build here because of this plant's growing. That's a wetlands plant, even though it wasn't wet. But, you know, there's a lot of weird stuff going on in that field. Point is, we have been given charge of the earth. Now, global warming is a whole other subject that we'll get into when we get into the flood, but we'll talk about that later. But in the meantime, God created us for his purpose. Now, there's another creation detail here that I had. I don't know where I got this, but God created the mule and told him, you are mule. You will work constantly from dusk to dawn, carrying heavy loads in your back. You will eat grass and lack intelligence. You'll live for 50 years. Well, the mule said, to live like that for 50 years, that's too much. Please give me no more than 20. And God said, let it be. Then God created the dog and said, you are dog. You will hold vigilance over the dwellings of man, to whom you will be his greatest companion. You will eat table scraps and live for 25 years. The dog said, Lord, to live like a dog for 25 years, that's too much. And he says, okay, no more than 10. And it was so. Then God created the monkey and told him, "You are monkey, you shall swing from tree to tree and act like an idiot. You will be funny and you shall live for 20 years. And the monkey said, "Lord, to live 20 years as the clown of the world is too much. Please give me no more than 10 years. And it was so. Finally, God created man and told him, "You are man, the only rational being that walks the earth. You'll use your intelligence to have mastery over the creatures of the world. You'll dominate the earth and live for 20 years. And the man responded, "Lord, 20 years? That's too little. Do you think I could have the 20 years the mule refused, the 15 years the dog refused, and the 10 years the monkey rejected?" And God said, "Okay." He made man to live for 20 years as a man, marry and live for 20 years like a mule, working and carrying loads on his back. Then he has children and lives 15 years as a dog, guarding his house and eating the leftovers after they empty out the pantry. And then in his old age to live like 10 years as a monkey, acting like an idiot to amuse his grandchildren. I'm at the monkey stage. Oh, I had to lighten up the science a bit, what can I say? Verse 29 says, God says, "See, I've given you every herb that yields seed, which is in the face of the earth." And by the way, you know, just the brilliance of the seed. If you could take one kernel of corn, I see I've got a little bit of deja vu here. Did I mention this already about the corn kernel? I know I did in the other services. Okay. Take a kernel of corn, put it in the ground, and it'll grow if you take care of it. And it's a 9x9 little plot, or 3x3, sorry, 9 square feet. It will grow up into a plant and it'll yield an ear of corn that will have on average some between 400, 1,200, about an average 800 kernels. If you take those 800 kernels the next year and you plant them, now you've got 800 plants producing 800 kernels. Then the next year you take that 800 times 800, which is 640,000, I believe. Then you plant the 640,000 plants and they grow and 800 produces them. At the end of 7 years, do you know that you'll have enough corn plants to fill the entire known land mass on the earth? 7 years. Now, I didn't believe that when I first read it, and I wasted 30 minutes trying to prove that mathematically, and it's so. If you want to prove it for yourself because you have an inquisitive mind, go at it. But it's true. It is an amazing thing. And God gives us this ability. And of course, we should have no problem feeding everybody in the world. Were it not for evil in politics, we wouldn't have a problem. Every tree which yields fruit yields seed. To you it shall be for food, and also to every beast of the earth, every bird of the air, to everything that creeps on the earth in which there is life, I've given every green herb for food. And it was so. Then God saw everything that he made, and indeed it was very good. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day.